Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes and this is The Unexplained. Really good to have you back there, and I'm talking to you under very, very sad circumstances for a whole variety of reasons. I don't even know where to begin. I'm recording this at the weekend. You'll probably hear it at the beginning of the coming week. We are well and truly into December. The British weather is grey and wet and windy and mild. And for all of this very odd week, I have been laid in my bed with a very severe bout of flu. I don't think I've ever had flu so bad. And it's just beginning to abate. But if I start coughing, my voice doesn't sound quite like me, you'll understand why. But that's not all of it, really. This has been a strange week. A number of people in my circle have left us recently, and that is incredibly sad. And then this morning I get up to catch up on some very sad news from the United States. I think you know that my radio hero for many years has been Art Bell. The fact that I'm sitting here now and trying out for the first time an Art Bell-style headset to do the show is all down to him. And it's so ironic that here I am using a headset identical to the one that Art used for all of those years and trying to get my head around how to use that because he used it so proficiently. And I read this news on his website. I'm sure you know about this if you're hearing me now and you're into these things. Art Bell, the man who devised this particular format and whose mantle I tried to carry here, if that's the word, to take on to some degree in the United Kingdom. You know, none of us will ever be Art Bell. But I tried to do something similar based on interviews and experiences that I've done and had. Tried to do something similar for Europe here. And now we read this. As you know, Art established Dark Matter Network, his own personal network, having decided to move on from the big networks for reasons that I completely understand, having worked in mainstream media myself. And I was part of that network, am part of that network. Anyway, this posting on Art Bell's own site, artbell.com, says this. And like I say, you've probably seen this. I'm sorry to have to announce this, but I will not be on tonight or any other night. Yes, I'm going to hang up. Whoever this crazy person is, they are not stopping, and it's come to the point that we, as a family, do not feel it is worth the risk. While I think the person or persons are after me, my wife and now my daughter are really scared. The other night, the latest incident, my daughter was off in the corner of her bed scared to death as police cars came screaming up. You may not know anything about this, but Art has a home that is pretty well publicized. It's his fortress in many ways. Certainly his cocoon from it all where he does his broadcasting. From what I can understand, this side of the Atlantic, somebody has been taking pot shots at that place. A situation that over here, look, I couldn't even imagine. So Art has decided to do the only thing that a reasonable person could do. You know, he's got to put his safety, and primarily the safety of his wife and daughter, at the paramount. There is nothing else you can do in this situation. But it's just the saddest news, really. It's very hard to take in. And I hope that Art will be back with us. And I have to say here and say now, and I'm sorry if I don't quite sound like me at the moment, that if I can have any part in assisting him and his project in the future to be with you again, then I will. But I'm a tiny little cog in a very big wheel in a very strange world. Thank you very much for all of your emails recently, by the way. I will get round to shout-outs in the next edition, but I did promise Tanner that I would mention his father's birthday. Tanner and his dad are in Salt Lake City, Utah, love the show, and they like me talking about the weather as well. And so I said I would mention Tanner's dad's birthday in Salt Lake City. It was December the 8th, sorry, I'm a little late for that. On this edition, I'm going to talk to a man called Philip Mantle. Now, he is a UFO investigator, as big as people like Nick Pope over here. but perhaps doesn't quite get the publicity that Nick Pope gets. But he is somebody who's facilitated other people's books. He's been co-author on a number and done a certain amount of very interesting research and a lot of teaching in this subject. I think you're going to find him a very interesting man. And his name has been mentioned to me over the years in a number of emails. So Philip Mantle will be the guest on this show. And one of the things we'll talk about is a new book that he's involved in called UFOs Over Poland, The Land of High Strangeness. I think you're going to like this. And this is a bit of a tribute to Art Bell, really, because I know this would be right up his street. Philip Mantle himself, though, number of books that he's been involved in or co-author on or consultant to, we'll talk about that as well, about his life and times. If you'd like to get in touch with me, as life hopefully begins to return to normal, you can do that. You can just go to the website, theunexplained.tv, and follow the link and send me an email. And if you'd like to send a donation as we come to the end of this year, I would certainly welcome that. I've lost a week of work with this terrible flu, and so if ever I needed the money to help me go forward, I do. Sorry, I shouldn't have said it that way. I don't mean to sound too forlorn. That's quite wrong, but it's been one hell of a week, one way or another. Thank you very much to Adam Cornwell, my webmaster at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool, for all of his hard work on all of this. And as I say, life will return to its normal frame, I'm sure, in the next edition. But let's cross to our guest now, way north of where I am in rainy, blowy London this morning, Philip Mantle. Philip, thank you very much indeed for coming on my show, The Unexplained.
My pleasure, Howard, indeed.
I don't know what your week has been like, Philip, but it's been a bit of a week from hell down here for one reason or another. But I think you've had it much worse weather-wise up there, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's been raining in biblical proportions the whole week, and it's still at it. I've taken my steps on to work today, and you know, there just seems to be no end in sight. And I feel sorry for those, you know, poor unfortunates who've had their houses and businesses flooded, and just seems no end in sight.
Yeah, I mean, we spend a lot of our time thinking about matters beyond this world, but every so often, nature and the hidden hand thereof intervenes and provides us with a little reminder that there is a force right down here that is bigger than any of us. And that force this week has been the weather that has forced people in the north of England, Carlisle particularly, but other areas as well, from their homes, deluged streets, forced boulders through hotels. I mean, literally, I saw one TV report where a boulder, you might have seen this thing, was swept down a swollen river that had gone through a little town or little village, and forced from the front door of this bar to the back door. The force of nature in these circumstances, but you know, it goes to once again pose the question, what is happening to our weather? If it isn't global warming, and I'm not saying it is or isn't, because I'm above my pay grade, I don't know. What is? Because this is not the kind of winter that I remember. I'm sitting here recording this in a T-shirt. Now, all right, I've had a massive boiling temperature and still have one with the flu this week, but something ain't right.
Well, no, I mean, you know, the weather certainly has changed over the last 10, 20 years of that, there's no doubt. You know, and we can all argue whether, you know, mankind has had an influence on that or not, but the fact remains it's changed. My best friend is Norwegian, for example, and he lives sort of the southern part of Norway. And I think, you know, for him, he's only had what he calls proper snow two or three times in the last 20 years, whereas a young man, they used to have it every year without fail.
Yeah, and no, we can talk a lot about that. You know, yeah. You and I grew up watching movies like, what's that one, Where Eagles Dare? Isn't it where Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood go and try and deal with a Nazi nuclear facility in Norway? And, of course, the snow was deep and thick, and they use skis.
That's the Heroes of Telemark.
Is it the... Okay. Heroes of Telemark. I knew it was one of the two.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love all those old movies, but they're always swathed in snow. Listen, my listeners are going to tell me to get on with it, so we better do this. I want to talk about you first. For a very good reason, because you've got a very long and very extensive track record in this entire field. And I have a feeling that if we haven't spoken before, I think several decades ago, we were in contact because I was trying to do a little documentary recording about UFOs and ufology. I was just getting into it all. And the only people, I mean, there was no internet then. The only way to get in touch with people was to buy magazines and phone numbers. And the only people that I could get hold of were an organization that you've been affiliated with for years called Bufora, and a woman called Jenny Randalls, who is the, still, I understand from what I read, still the doyen of Bufora.
Well, no, Jenny's no longer with Bufora, the British UFO Research Association. She was their director of investigations for many years, and when Jenny left the scene, you know, it's a role that I took over from her.
Right, okay, because I seem to remember that when I was trying to get hold of Jenny back then, one of the names that came up was Philip Mantle. Is that possible? We're talking a long time ago.
I mean, I worked, you know, hand in glove with Jenny on many things at the time. You know, we had it was called a council, but we had a committee of such that had various roles at Bufora, and you know, I was also their conference organizer for many years. I also served as press officer for an awful long time. So, if Jenny didn't speak to members of the media, you know, it would cross my desk as well.
Well, that actually answers the question then, and that's why I know your name, apart from listeners getting in touch with me for the last couple of years, suggesting you as a guest. I think you and I may have spoken in the early 1980s. Long
quite
time ago.
Possibly, Howard. You know, I recognise those dulcet tones from somewhere.
You must forgive me if I just have a quick cough. When this flu gets you, and I hope it doesn't get you, it doesn't let you go. All right, explain to me how a guy from the north of England, living what I guess is, you know, the kind of life that I'm from the north of England too, live there. How do you get involved in UFOs and ufology? Isn't that for people who live out in the Nevada desert?
It's a good question, that, Howard. I mean, you know, I mean, going right back, I mean, I'm in my late 50s now, and you know, I grew up as a child enthralled in the space race. You know, I was 11 years old when Apollo astronauts landed on the moon, and yes, they did land on the moon, and I was absolutely astounded by it all. I mean, I always had an interest, Howard, in all things to do with astronomy. The paranormal, even as a young man. I mean, my mum was from Northern Ireland, and I remember at a very early age, she told me a story of when she met a fairy in rural Ireland. They lived in the middle of nowhere, and to her, she said, "I don't know if I imagined it or not, son, but to me, it was very real." I always had an interest in science fiction. Mm-hmm. So all these things, you know, seemed to get mixed up together and combined. And I read one little newspaper article once about UFOs in one of the dailies. I don't know which one. And I thought, well, what a lot of nonsense. You know, I used to go on occasion with a friend's grandmother to the spiritualist church. And whilst I found it fascinating, I found it something not quite right. I don't mean they were faking it or anything like that. There's something to me just didn't add up. And of course, I just went to a normal, you know, high school, and we were taught religious instruction, not education. We were taught once a week bits about the Bible as being fact, and I was one of those that would put their hands up and ask questions and get into trouble for it. I mean, I think I was about 12 or 13. And I read the Bible from cover to cover. It took me a while, but I thought, well, I better try and understand why I'm getting in trouble, because things just didn't seem to make sense to me. So I always had an inquisitive mind, and then in the late 1970s, of course, the movie Close Encounters was out, and a friend and I were down in Wiltshire. We went to use a telescope. It was a chap had built his own little observatory. And, you know, just so happens, we couldn't use it that night for whatever reason. I think it was cloudy. So that, you know, that kind of puts the kibosh on looking through a telescope. And I was reading a book, and it had one chapter on UFOs, and it mentioned a place nearby to where we were staying in Wiltshire. And it was a little town called Warminster, and apparently in the 60s they'd had a lot of sightings there. And quite literally, Howard, we were pretty bored and with nothing to do, so we jumped in the car and found this place, parked on the hillside, and we saw these strange lights. We were looking over, from our vantage point, you could see right across Salisbury Plain. We knew they weren't astronomical in nature, and they certainly didn't look like aeroplanes. In hindsight, they were probably something to do with the military. We didn't know at the time that the parts of Salisbury Plain were used for military training exercise, and there's still a military base even in there today.
And of course, if you get involved in the whole ufology thing around Warminster and around Wiltshire, very much a hotspot, and there are people, I've had them on this program, who will tell you that not only do the military do exercises there, but sometimes they chase these things.
Well, yeah, I mean, that could well be, but, you know, this sparked the interest, and rather naively, I thought, I'll write a couple of letters and I'll soon get an answer to all this, you know, and I found the address, because, again, this was long before the internet, and I wrote to the British UFO Research Association and I asked a few questions, and to my great surprise, you know, I discovered they didn't have all the answers, so I wanted to find out for myself. And then, by pure coincidence, I started talking to my family members about this, and my aunt, an Auntie Emily, who lived nearby, she brought me our local newspaper in Leeds. It was still going, the Yorkshire Evening Post, and it had a small little advertisement in it for a UFO group. The Yorkshire UFO Society had just been formed, and they're having a meeting at this particular venue in Leeds. I lived just outside of Leeds at the time.
The Yorkshire I've never heard of it.
Yeah, the Yorkshire UFO Society. Mm. And off I went Sunday afternoon, 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, whatever time it was, and it was organised and founded by brothers Graham and Mark Birdsall. Graham Birdsall, of course, went on to publish UFO magazine, which was hugely successful throughout the 1990s and the noughties,
and became a bit of in this field a bit of a rock star.
Absolutely, and I was absolutely enthralled, you know. And again, just by coincidence, we were very fortunate that I got more and more interested, that throughout the 1980s, in and around the north of England, certainly the Yorkshire Dales and the Pennine areas, we were literally inundated with UFO sightings. And, you know, we had a membership at the Yorkshire UFO Society at that time of about, I don't know, 30 or 40 people, and that continued to grow, but we literally couldn't cope. We had so many sightings. Obviously, we could explain a lot, but there were certain areas, not, you know, in the moors, above Skipton, for example, particular areas there called Calton Moor, and over the border into Lancashire.
Yeah, there seemed to be a little, almost triangle, a little epicentre of it all, around the Yorkshire-Lancashire border, places like Todmorden, as they call it.
And
Saddleworth.
Throughout the 80s, Howard, right the way through, we had everything. I mean, you name it, and we encountered it. And so I just got more and more involved and more fascinated. And the more I learned, the more I wanted to know. I kept asking more and more questions.
Did it frustrate you, Philip, at the time? Now, look, you and I are both from the north of England. I've been in the south for a lot of years, but my heart is still up there in Liverpool. Did it frustrate you that most of the talk about ufology in the 80s, and I remember it well, was to do with, to do with the southeast of England, or to do with Wiltshire, which is in the west of England, and there was very little talk about stuff happening in the north?
Well, I don't think it frustrated it as such, because we were too busy concentrating on what we were doing. And of course, you know, as we said, there was no internet in those days. So, you know, we formed our own little newsletter. Now that became Quest magazine. We bought our own little printing machine and figured out how to work it and printed a couple of hundred copies and collated it by hand. And that eventually, evolved into UFO magazine. Full glossy high street publication, and which went on sale around the world. But you know, we were quite content to be involved with enough on our plates and didn't worry about what was going on elsewhere in the country, or we weren't getting any recognition. We were convinced at one point, Alan, that if we were patient enough and determined enough, whatever the UFO phenomenon was, we could confront it, you know, head on, face to face.
Well, that's interesting. Did you talk during that pioneering period with anybody who had confronted it, as you say, face to face, head on?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of our sort of main members, if you like, was he's now sadly no longer with us, was former police sergeant Tony Dodd. Tony lived in Grassington in the Yorkshire Dales, and, you know, he at first got reports, and he wanted to know what was happening on his patch. And what they used to do, they would literally park on the moors at night above Skipton, because their radio transmission was better rather than down in the hills and dales. And Tony and his colleague, you know, encountered a UFO, and they were astonished. This object with three large lights underneath came very low. Tony switched the blue lights on, and he's convinced that this thing reacted. It turned around and came back. He took two photographs, not at that time, but with, you know, later sightings that coincided with a lot of things that were being reported by other people. And we spent many days and hours interviewing people, you know, face to face, all around these areas, not just there, but it moved further down into the Pennine areas, into around Sheffield and into the Peak District and other areas of the Pennines, and like I said, across the border. I mean, we did a little PR exercise one week on Carlton Moor. We literally packed a caravan there and stayed in it for a week. We did some local lectures and some local press, and we encouraged people to come and report things to us. And we were averaging, you know, about 10 or 12 people driving up onto the moor. There wasn't a lot of passing traffic. There was certainly no footfall, Howard. They had to come and find us with a couple of handmade signs that we'd stuck on the side of the road. So
in other words, the people who came to see you were ones who really wanted to and had a reason to. Got it.
Yeah, and what we found was that this wasn't a recent phenomenon. You know, this was going back decades. I mean, we managed to befriend some of the local farming community that had been there man and boy. And they told us about, you know, things their parents had discussed and grandparents. So it certainly wasn't a recent phenomenon.
And do you think, that's curious, isn't it? Do you think that people in that area, the farmers, you know, they're all hardened people. They see life in all its hues and shades. Do you think that they'd come to accept these things as a part of life, just a part of existence there?
Well, they just, you know, they accepted it. It didn't do them any harm. It didn't necessarily scare their livestock if they were livestock farmers. They certainly didn't view it as a threat. Mm.
And no cattle or sheep mutilations, anything
not
like that?
Not at all, no. It was just there, you know, and it only happened occasionally. It was bizarre. It was confusing. They didn't call it spaceships or anything like that. They just said we saw these. I remember once interviewing one chap who had a farm, and he also had a cattery. And he said they were like five big orange dinner plates. And this was down in the valley. This wasn't, you know, several thousand feet above his farm, doing, you know, acrobatic manoeuvres the likes of which he'd never seen. And he had no explanation for it whatsoever. Mm. And with lots of things like that, not just from him, but from many, many dozens of people around the area.
Now, if you think this is strange, isn't it? And this is probably rubbish, but I'm sure you've heard it before. There are some people who say that these phenomena, if they exist, are attracted to power sources, things like radio frequency, that kind of stuff. Now, that whole area has a number of very high power broadcast masts. There's the enormous mast at Emley Moor, which is the big television mast. There's one at Winter Hill, the other side of the Pennines. And there's a great big one that carries radio these days, used to carry very high power television at Home Moss. I wonder if there's any connection that you found to do with those.
Well, we looked at every possible connection. I mean, you know, we get the map out and we plot these things on the map. But of course, you know, some of the sightings that came our way, you know, predate any of these constructions, long before Home Moss and Emley Moor. But there are natural power sources as well that some people claim. There's also fault lines in the area. you know, around the Dales of the North and South Craven fault lines. And then, of course, in more recent years, you've got much smaller ones. You've got the microwave repeaters for the mobile phones now and things like that. So it's very difficult. You know, people claim that they are attracted to a whole host of things. There's old mine workings in the area that have long since gone. So when you look at a map, Howard, you can kind of connect it to anything you want, really, if you try hard enough. But we did literally looked at every kind of possibility. But the fact remains that they were there. You know, it wasn't a recent phenomenon. They had been there down the decades. Myths and legends at times have grown up around these things. For example, I'm sure everybody knows, you know, the story of the calendar girls and the Women's Institute and their calendar and, you know, and the movie and now
very,
the
very famous film, yeah.
Well, yeah, but we, you know, I remember just near the village where these ladies come from, going to interview a couple. And to kind of, it's so small, these you know, the house didn't even have numbers on, you know, and have no names. You just thought, well, where they live. And I knocked on the door and I said, can you help me? I'm trying to find and Mr. and Mrs. So and so. And, oh, have you come about the black dog? So that when it all turned out, it wasn't actually a black dog. What they used to see was two orange lights that used to float down the valley. And of course, that had then equated into being the eyes of this devil dog. Nobody actually saw a dog, but they just saw two luminous spheres floating around. So, you know, the sightings themselves had taken on, you know, myth and legendary status down the decades. And that was common in the area, but all the more fascinating, you know. And, you know, we could guarantee that at certain times of the year we knew we'd get observations from these areas. They never have went away. They would have peaks and troughs in how many, you know, sightings were reported to us, but they would always be there. They're always, and still are, Howard, you know, that hasn't changed. What they are, well, whether they're attracted to anything in particular, you know, that remains a subject of much debate.
Mm. And what about the interest of authorities in some of these cases in these areas? You know, the MOD, for example, the government, we know that local police often report these things or see these things, and local pilots see these things. But what about officialdom? Did they take an interest in these things?
We didn't do too bad, certainly in the 1980s. I mean, obviously in the local area, you know, Tony Dodd was well known as because he lived at the police station as well, so he was known, you know, on an official basis as the police officer. And to be quite honest, we could sometimes name drop and use his name. Other areas, and I remember going to interview a family who'd seen these things. And what they'd done at the time, they made drawings of them, and they reported it to the police, and the police came out. And I said, well, what happened to your drawings? And they said, oh, the police took them away.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, you know, which station was it? And I went to the police station. I introduced myself. We used to have little business cards, and I handed it in. And they said, yeah, no problem, Mr. Mallon. They got them, and they gave them. But it differed from one station to another. There didn't seem to be any official policy. And I got the impression with some police departments, they were only too happy to hand this stuff over to you because they
well, they wouldn't know what to do with it for a start.
Yeah.
Off, yeah.
Yeah, they'd more important things.
Yeah, I completely understand. Look, my dad was a copper, and yeah. And he had strange experiences. One of these days, I'll collate them and talk about them. But you know, sometimes it was just better to hand this stuff off. What I was wondering about is whether the Ministry of Defence or any of the, you know, the alphabet agencies got involved. At all, as far as you know?
Not that I'm aware of. We pestered the living daylights out of the Ministry of Defence. We also had a good working relationship with all the airports, and that's both military and civil, wherever we could around the area. I mean, we had a good relationship with Leeds Bradford Airport, for example, RAF Finningley, which is now closed, Binbrook in Lincolnshire, and various other ones. Because we didn't talk about flying saucers and little green men, we just stuck to the phrase, you know, UFO, and we built this relationship over the years, and we're polite, and more often than not, if they could and if they had the time, they would respond and they would help us. Now, there was also a time when I was with the British UFO Research Association, Howard, that if you rang the MOD to report a UFO sighting, yes, they'd take the details, but they'd also give you my telephone number. Because I used to ask people when they phoned, because we didn't advertise, you couldn't find us in the phone book, where have you got my phone number from? And there were several people. I said, well, I rang the Ministry of Defence, and they gave, this was, you know, a phone number we used for UFO sightings, but it was also my house phone number, and that amazed me. You know, there were various police stations would do that for us, there was various RAF bases would do that for us. So, you know, I never found any official involvement, you know, and it just depended who you spoke to at mm-hmm. the time, and if they knew you and they knew you weren't a crank, then you were doing okay.
Were you ever warned off, or were you seen as a bunch of happy amateurs?
Never warned off, never had any threats. We did have a lot of our posts interfered with at one point. And we actually made an official complaint to the postmaster in Leeds. And he actually came out to see us in person, and he said, well, you know, the post would come, and we'd get it, but it would be opened and officially resealed. And he said, that happens from time to time, you know, you will get one or two letters that come open. And
really? But they come open or are opened?
Well, but then, you know, I remember the look on his face when Graham said, well, Graham Birdsall, he kept all these, and he said, well, what about this lot? And it wasn't just one or two, it was dozens. Mm. You know, and Graham had kept them all, and he just piled them on the desk in front of him. And the chap didn't know what to say. He was dumbfounded. Now, whether there was anything sinister in that, whether they thought we were a bunch of nutcases or whatever, I honestly don't know. But so there was a little bit of that.
You made a great leap, and I want to talk about this in our remaining time, from being somebody who collated UFO reports mainly in your own Yorkshire area to somebody who got involved in publishing books and being involved in research about some of the most famous cases of the world. How did you make that step? It seems to me it happened for you and to you and with you from the sort of mid to late 80s into the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, you know, things, you know, I never planned anything really, Howard. You know, things just tended to happen. I mean, I moved on from the Yorkshire UFO Society in the late 80s. I rejoined the British UFO Research Association, became more and more involved. And of course, with Bufora, I wasn't just linked to Yorkshire. I was, you know, stuff would cross my desk from all over the place. And I also joined the Mutual UFO Network, which is a worldwide organization with its HQ in the States. Became their representative for England, and I began to do lectures, and people would write to me. I remember one incident. I'll give you an example, Howard. I think it was about 1987. There was an incident in a place called Voronezh in the Soviet Union, where this thing had landed. The locals said they saw this thing land and these strange beings, and even TASS, the official news agency, put out a statement confirming all this. And I got a phone call from a Russian newspaper, and I'll try and pronounce it. Not easy for a Yorkshireman, but it was called Izvestia.
Izvestia, hi. Okay, well, that's a big one. If you're going to be in contact with a newspaper, you can't get much bigger.
They sent me a copy of it. Obviously, I couldn't read a word of it apart from my name. And then I started getting letters, and it just said, Philip Mantle, UFOs. I used to live in a small town then called Batley, England. And they would arrive, and it was some UFO researchers in the Soviet Union, but mainly members of the public would arrive. I couldn't read any of it.
And this was pre-1990. This was pre the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. And, things just happened by chance. And then, of course, in the early to mid-1990s, I became involved with the infamous alien autopsy film. Again, you know, I was Bufora's press officer, and a letter from a company and a gentleman called Ray Santilli landed on my desk talking about making a documentary film, and I rang him up, and he went on to tell me this story about having this film of Roswell. long story, going to cut very short. You know, it eventually turned out to be a monumental money-making scam, but it was
Well, at the time, though, I mean, this, you know, alien autopsy film and all the rest of it has been widely debunked, I think, by a lot of people. What did you believe about it when you first viewed it?
Well, again, it's a long story, but Santilli first contacted us in 1993. And initially, I said, just about making a documentary. And I rang him up, and he went on to say, well, I've actually got film of Roswell, you know, the aliens being cut open, dissected. And I said, show me. Yes, I can. No, I can't. Yes, I can. No, I can't. I met him in London. I was employed at one point to help promote the movie Fire in the Sky. And we had Travis Walton, whom the movie is based on, and his brother-in-law, Mike Rogers, come and do a lecture for us in London. And Santilli's offices were quite nearby, so I invited him to attend. He told me the story. He'd been in America looking for, you know, bits of old music and videos or film. He'd bought this from a mysterious cameraman, and you know, and so I said, show me. Anyway, I said, oh, forget it. In 1995, so we're jumping forward now about 18 months or so, I'd got his business card, and I was sent a VHS video of a movie called Roswell that was being released by Sony Pictures. It was only a very, very small release. It was made by Showtime in America for TV.
Yeah, no, I saw it. I liked it. It was good, but not many people saw it, though.
Yeah, but I got this video, and it reminded me about Santilli. So this was early 95, and I rang him up again. I said, "Are you still claim to have this film?" And he said, "But yes, Philip, but you don't believe me." I said, "Well, I can't believe you until I see it. It's just another fantastic story." So he says, "Okay, make an appointment with my secretary. Come down to London, and I'll show you." So over the next few months, I made two or three trips to London, and hey, presto, he showed me it. So, thinking on my feet, you know, I was also Bufora's conference organizer, and in 1995 I had a conference organized in Sheffield for August, all done dusted. This was about April time when I saw the film, and I just said off the top of my head, show it at our conference. And he said, yeah, on one condition, you help me research it. So we shook hands, and that's what happened. I mean, none of us knew what was going to happen with this thing. I just thought it would make an interesting topic. I thought, if we can get it out in the public, Howard, you know, Santilli at that point had no TV involved. He was just going to sell it on sell-through. You had to buy it from him. You had to buy a video. And you know, the story got out, again, by accident, and then it just went around the world. I was getting phone calls and faxes from, you know, places I didn't even know existed. And the rest, as they say, is history. But when I saw it, I thought, well, at least here's a film. If we can get it out into the public domain, then people can scrutinize it. You know, they might come forward and say, that's me, I'm one of the actors. No, but my granddad told me about this, you know, it really happened, and whatever scenario you want to imagine. But nothing happened. The film was shown around the world, it made Santilli a ton of money, but not a peep. Nobody came forward one way or the other. And I remember having lunch with Santilli in London, and I stared him in the eyes, and I said, I will get to the bottom of this film. And he just said, that's fine, Philip. I didn't realise it'd take me, you know, it took me 14 years in the end, but I did.
Your book about this, you know, if that started in 1995, then it wasn't published until the end of the 2000s.
That's right. I published it a few years ago. I finally, again, it's a long story, but the film, among many other people that scrutinised it, was scrutinised by a special effects company in America. And they literally went through it frame by frame. And the special effects artist, it was called the Really Dangerous Company, and the artist was Trey Stokes. He was the main guy. And he wrote what you would call a blooper list, little errors. But you literally had to sit down and be a bit of a geek and follow his instructions and to look for. And there was little things that didn't prove it was a fake, but thought there's something not quite right here. It doesn't add up. And they were the kind of things that only a special effects artist really would notice.
Were they things like the movement within the frames?
You know, when they cut the head open, the head wobbles.
Oh.
And it doesn't look like it's attached to the body. There's no snot. You know, little things like that. But it's a tiny little thing. Underneath of the body, for example, was still perfectly formed. But however, this is a bit gruesome, but when you die and you lay a body down, all your bodily fluids sink to the bottom part. So the bottom of your, where you lay it out, is flat. It's like squashed almost.
I'm just trying to hold out a little hope for this, but aliens may be different.
Well, you know, when they cut it open, it had got giblets and things like that, like the rest of us, only just different giblets. So
you see, we've got to say that there were a lot of people who were going around. I mean, I was pretty convinced when I first saw a clip of this thing. A lot of people believing this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was a sensation. I mean, don't get me wrong. And there's still people believing it to this very day, even despite the fact that, you know, the man who led the team that faked it is a chap called Spiros Moularis, whom I've got to meet and view all his evidence, and I've published most of it in my book. But the people don't believe that.
So, did you ever ask the question, why would anybody want to fake something like this?
Money. It's as simple as that, you know.
See, I'm very naive. I hadn't thought of that.
I mean, Santilli never made any secret that his only interest in this was to commercialise it. I mean, that was everybody knew that from the beginning. Mm.
And as long as you honestly present it as something over which there is a question mark, as long as there remains a question mark, then you make of it whatever you will. And if you're going to make money out of it, well, that's a fair deal.
I had no problem with that, you know. It's a commercial world that we live in, Howard.
Mm. But what do you think? As somebody who investigated for years UFO cases and spoke to many sincere people who believe they'd had experiences, how do you feel that that incident and that drama left ufology?
I think it did us a lot of good. I think it did the subject a lot of good. Because, the most famous debunker at the time was Philip Klass. Philip's no longer with us, but, he condemned it as a fake, which is his right, but he couldn't prove it. And there were many people around the world that couldn't prove it was a fake. It's very easy, Howard, to label anything as hocus pocus or a fake. I mean, that's the easy way. But to prove it is a different matter. So at the end of the day, the main guy who was involved in it, i.e. me, took the time and the effort to stick at it to finally get to the bottom of it. I didn't know where the bottom of it was. I just followed the leads that came my way and I kept at it. So it was ufology, and a recognized UFO researcher who eventually exposed it for being exactly what it was. And there were those, well, I said, I told you so. I said, well, yeah, but that's easy. You couldn't prove it, And I did. I proved it and I stuck at it. I mean, there's people still researching Roswell itself now, all these many years later. And you say, well, why bother? Because they want to get to the bottom of it. Now, some believe they have already. Others think they haven't. I didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, there was lots of theories about the alien autopsy film. Maybe Santilli himself had been conned. Maybe he bought it in good faith. And it was somebody else that had done it. But I got to the bottom of it eventually. I didn't think it'd take that long, but I got there.
And you're quite happy to close the file on that. Do you think that somewhere might exist a similar sort of film of the real thing?
Well, there's always a possibility. It's the old phrase, isn't it? Never say never. But we had the fiasco, earlier this year of the Roswell slides in Mexico. I don't know if you're aware of that, Howard, mm-hmm. but, TV presenter Jaime Massaun and a few researchers said we've got these slides, 35mm slides, and they are, pictures of the alien at Roswell. I think they had two slides or two or three. And, of course, as soon as they were released into the public, there was a big fanfare and a big presentation in Mexico. Thousands of people turned up and paid their money for it. And, of course, when you see the slides, they're actually a mummy, a human mummy. It's been tracked to one of the... to the exact museum that this thing was on display.
Yeah, no, we've talked about that here before. Yeah. And I just wonder, ufology is a great I think most of these fields are, but is a great centre for conspiracy theories. And there are people who say, well, of course, you know, periodically there are going to be fakes put out there in order to throw genuine researchers like your good self off the scent.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't always have a lot of time for conspiracy. I mean, again, you look at the Roswell slides, it was a, you know, a commercial thing, and that's it. But, you know, what is curious in a lot of, when you talk about film is the lack of it. And people will argue that, you know, well, it's hidden away, or it's you know, it's stashed in an attic somewhere, and that may well be. But when you think about, you know, certainly today's technology, Howard, we've all got phones. Most of the phones that we carry on our belts or in our pockets have got some kind of camera on them, still or video. But yet, the images that we see haven't improved an awful lot.
They haven't. But I tell you what, this year of all, you know that I work some of my week on a news desk, and I get to see the world's media. And I have to say that 2015 has been the year of people recording, videoing, photographing stuff that they claim may be alien. And some of it is absolutely ludicrous and laughable. There's one going around at the moment. A few news websites, so-called, are running this one. It's a photograph of something, you've probably seen it, Philip, of a Boeing 747 being shadowed by something sort of cigar-shaped.
It
looks pretty, you know, in the literal sense of the word, it looks pretty incredible to me.
Well, again, you know, again, one of the difficulties we have, of course, is modern technology. You know, the days have gone when special effects were just for the film studios. You can do it on your home computer. So, you know, an image is only as good as the story and the people that go with it.
But do you think that this will kill ufology because it is so easy to fake it up now?
Well, let's put it this way, Howard. If you were, you know, honest, and you were out today or tomorrow, and you genuinely saw something, let's just call it anomalous, and you got out your camera or your camera phone and you filmed it, what would you do with it? Would you put it straight up on YouTube? I don't think so. I really don't. I'm not saying you'd go and sell it, but certainly when I first started, there were a number of people that did keep things for years. You know, they'd have photographs that they'd never shown anybody. But on occasion, people would be curious enough to want to get to the bottom of what they'd seen and what they'd filmed. And they would speak to the local police station or even the local newspaper, you know, and say, can you help me get to the bottom of this, please? And there was no financial incentive involved. You know, I got called in by a few of the national newspapers to look up photographs that people had sent in, and they weren't after making any money out of it. They weren't, not saying they'd have turned any down, of course, but that wasn't their motive. And I mean, one of the most convincing UFO photographs from Britain comes from a chap in Scotland. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but it was taken at a place called Craigluskar Reservoir in broad daylight. And I've met the chap, you know, and he handed it over to a colleague of mine, Malcolm Robinson, you know, lock, stock and barrel. And he didn't want any publicity, you know, didn't want any money, just, you know, here you go, mate. You know, what this chap did, he was an artist. So we would go to certain locations and take a few location photographs and then go home and paint rather than stand there with the easel all day. And he was at Craigluskar Reservoir taking a few snaps, and he took two of this, you know, this thing, this object. It's in daylight. It looks like some kind of disc shape or discus. And I met him purely by accident. You know, my wife used to live in Scotland, and we went to visit some friends, and he lived next door, you know. And it's one of the very few, I would say, photographs from anywhere in the world. And there was no financial motive, you know. And I spoke to my wife's friends who knew him. Hmm. And they said, no, he's just a regular guy, you know. So, yes.
Well, you know, look, you mentioned, and I'm sorry to interrupt, Malcolm Robinson. We had him on this show, I think, a year, probably 2 years ago. And Malcolm was telling me the most hair-raising tales of almost being able, up in Scotland, in remote parts of Scotland, near a military base up there. He told me tales of almost being able to summon UFOs and orbs and bizarre stuff. It was almost like a regular show, and everybody up there knew about it. Now, I haven't been able to speak to Malcolm since that, but that was quite remarkable, and I'm very interested that you know him.
Yeah, I've known Malcolm many times, many years, I should say. And, you know, we're on very good friendly terms. And, you know, I've been to interview a few people with Malcolm, shared the lecture podium with him on many occasions. And, you know, but again, you know, there are areas that have, I wouldn't say you can summon them at will, but, you know, have hot spots from time to time about UFOs. I've mentioned the Dales and various others. You know, Bonnybridge in Scotland was the same. And people sometimes can read a little bit too much into it. You can go on, I can guarantee it'll be there. And it's not always the case where you just read a bit too much into it. But Malcolm has investigated some most, you know, bizarre encounters.
Well, it did seem to me when I spoke to him that he sounded like he was getting very close to something. And I was a little worried for him at one point.
Well, we were the same in the 80s in the Dales. You know, we were convinced that whatever this phenomenon was, if we were persistent enough and patient enough, we could confront it face to face. Never managed to do that. I did see something up there that I couldn't identify, but it wasn't at close quarters. And but it wasn't for the want of trying, I can assure you. So there are hot spots, and certainly Scotland has had its share of it. And,
okay. Two quick things to talk about as we've got, 15 minutes or so left. So I want to try and get these two things in. One, of course, is the new book that you're involved in about UFOs in Poland. The other one, briefly if we can, but we need to touch on this. One of the books that you co-authored, and you've been quite prolific in partnering with authors and co-authoring with them and publishing, is Without Consent. This is about alien abductions in the United Kingdom. Now, we hear lots of cases from the United States. We don't hear that many cases of people being abducted from the UK, unless you know different.
Well, no, I mean, again, Without Consent was my first book back in 1994, long out of print. My co-author is a chap called Carl Nagatis. Carl's a lifelong journalist. I met Carl when he worked, I believe it was for the Mirror Group, and he now runs his own PR company. Speaking to him just the other day, and it was just by coincidence that, you know, I did a couple of articles with Carl in his newspaper days, and it piqued his interest. And originally, Without Consent was designed as a TV documentary. I was employed to write a TV documentary, they pulled the plug on it. And so we turned it into a book. And we did it for a reason, like you just said, Howard, is because that certainly, more so in the early 90s, that the idea was that, you know, abductions only happened in America and, you know, to some person out in the middle of nowhere. And we knew that wasn't the case. That wasn't true. So I literally, along with Carl, set about gathering what documented evidence there was already, and there was a few that we were aware of, and I travelled the length and breadth of Britain, you know, interviewing as many people as I could about their experiences face to face, and most of which ended up in Without Consent. And we don't sort of favour any theory as to what lies behind these incidents. We put a few theories forward, but leave the reader to make up their own mind. But the way we wrote Without Consent is to show you that these incidents, these encounters, happen to ordinary people who at the time are just about their everyday task. You know, they're going to work, walking the dog, having a walk in the park, whatever. Police Constable Alan Godfrey, for he's a prime example from Todman in the late 70s. He's on patrol in his patrol car when this thing happens, you know. And I literally, some of the, you know, people I interviewed wouldn't allow us to use their real name or wouldn't allow us even to publish the stuff. You know, nobody was out looking for publicity.
What sort of, do they boil? I mean, you said that a police constable, we've heard the case of Alan Godfrey, but could you boil down a particular kind of person who would report having been abducted?
Not at all, no. I mean, again, you know, my experience, it's just a cross spectrum of the general public. I mean, you know, I interviewed a painter and decorator, you know, a teacher, you know, an unemployed housewife who's out with her daughter. I mean, you know, you name it. And there was no age group, no particular area in the country, no ethnic background or religious background. I mean,
and any commonalities in their stories?
That's difficult to say because each story is different. And I mean entirely different. No two are exactly the same. There were a number of people who, not necessarily their story, but how they encounter affected them, if you like. It seemed to have a positive effect. They became more aware of environmental issues, if you like, or of spirituality and green issues.
Is that because of, this sounds very Betty and Barney Hill, is that because of what they imparted to them about what we are doing to this planet?
Not necessarily, no, because, you know, some of them, no information was imparted to them at all. You know, they just had this very bizarre experience. Whereon, with one young man whom I interviewed at length in Pwllheli in Wales, they did show him pictures or film of the Earth in the future, predicting doom and disaster, environmental disaster. This was a young lad with his jeans, you know, and T-shirt and his rock music, and he became interested in environmental issues as a direct result of that. Others weren't shown anything, so again, there was no one common feature there at all. And we tried to emphasise, look, these people are not fruitcakes, they're not mental, you know, they are just normal human beings. A lot of them didn't say, I've had an encounter with an alien. They just said, I had this most bizarre or this most unusual experience or series of experiences, and I don't know what it is. I think it's important, and I think it's important that people know about it, but I don't know what it is. You know, and we were fortunate, certainly in around about that time, because Nick Pope was becoming prominent from the Ministry of Defence, so that added an air of credibility. We had Dr. John Mack as well, a Harvard professor, who again added an air of credibility. So it did tempt one or two people to come out of the woodwork and go on the record, whereas previously they wouldn't. And we were grateful for what they did, and it's still a fascinating subject.
You said that a lot of these people found themselves in some way enhanced by the experience. Did any of them find themselves, as you sometimes read, traumatised in an ongoing way?
Oh, well, certainly the young man I mentioned in Pwllheli in Wales, David, I mean, he was absolutely terrified by it as well, Howard. I mean,
But in an ongoing way?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I'll give you an example. You know, I went back many, many, many months after this had happened, and I asked him to take me to the area where it happened, just so I could take some photographs, and he was petrified. In the end, he had to go and have hypnotherapy, not regressive hypnosis, but hypnotherapy, because he was having nightmares about it. It scared the... you know, you talk to him about his music or his girlfriend or his job, and he was just like any other young lad with long hair. But then you talk about this subject, and his whole personality was changed. You know, he would shake, he would chain smoke. Whilst he talked to me about it, he didn't like doing it. And when Without Consent came out, I sent most of the people in the book, I sent them a copy, and I sent this young man a copy. And I think it was 4 years before he read it. You know, he just
couldn't confront it. He couldn't face it.
You know, and again, you know, make of that what you will, Howard, you know. But that's the kind of effect it had on him.
And Philip, you know, I didn't know that much about you before we had this conversation, but you're pretty unique in the amount of research in this country that you've done. So I'm getting to a point here, don't worry. The point is this. One of the things I read online about you is that you're a bit of an unsung hero, and people like Nick Pope, who is internationally known, and others in this country, get all the limelight, and you don't. I'm not saying that's so or that isn't so, but how do you feel when people say that about you?
Well, it's very flattering, but, you know, and thank you very much, you know, but with a great respect, you know, Nick is the man from the ministry. Or was, actually now retired from the MOD. I know him very well. I have the greatest respect for him. I personally don't have a problem with that at all, you know. I didn't enter into this subject for any personal gain. I entered into it because of my curiosity, and that curiosity is still there, Howard. I want to know. I've had lots of the questions I had as a young man have been answered, but by no means them all. And you know, the more you get involved, the more questions you seem to have.
And you told me that you're in your late 50s, and a lot of people who do this kind of stuff seem to be there or thereabouts. Do you worry about how this research will be taken forward in future generations? Are there young people coming forward just as interested as you?
Yeah, I think there are some, and what I've made it an effort down the years is to try and encourage the next generation to get involved. I mean, I've lectured at schools, for example, in the past, and I'm talking high schools, and they ask more intelligent questions than anybody, but there are young people, like there are in any subject, and this subject, it goes in peaks and troughs in the levels of interest, and I'm sure that will continue to happen. But I remember working with a young lady at a high school in America, and she wanted to write an essay about this, so I gave her some pointers. So I've tried to encourage wherever I can, and I will continue to do so.
Well, you put some very good stories across very well, and you sound, totally sincere about your work, Philip. Let's talk quickly about the new book, and we'll talk, I think, on another edition in more detail about the subject. But the new book is, and it's only just out, UFOs Over Poland, and it's a bit of a co-production. You're involved with a Polish author about this, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I've not written any of it, I've edited it. The author, Peter, speaks very good English, but writing is a different matter. His written English is pretty good, but I've edited a couple of magazines down the years, and Peter wrote a couple of articles for us, which I found fascinating. And when we're dealing with a subject like this, Howard, we tend to concentrate on what's happened in the West, because we all speak English and we can read it. And it's quite clear that, certainly with my involvement with things in Russia, for example, that I knew that there's a vast amount of information out there that we're not aware of, simply because of the language barrier.
True, and there are many, many people, including young people, in places like Poland, massively interested. How do I know this? My hairdresser, Paulina, locally where I live, she's Polish, very nice, very intelligent woman. She's 25. And she didn't know that I do this show or anything about me particularly. She started to talk about all of these things and how fascinating she found them. And she'd heard some stories herself in Poland. So I know that there is tremendous interest there.
Well, and absolutely. I mean, Peter sent me a manuscript probably about 18 months ago, asking if he knew anyone that might be interested in it. He's had his own work published in his own country, of course. And I read it and I thought, this is fascinating stuff. And a couple of colleagues, encouraged me to set up self-publishing, the technology that we have today with print on demand and all that kind of thing. So I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. And middle of this year, I got on with editing it and I took the plunge. I formed my own little title called Flying Disc Press, and Peter's book, UFOs Over Poland, The Land of High Strangeness, it is the first of the titles that I'm going to publish, and it's out now, and it's had some terrific reviews already.
I've got the news release, the press release for it here, and it's, if I may say so, it's a great and detailed press release. Well, I get these things for a living across my desk all the time. It says here, the book is peppered with many bizarre and anomalous sightings, and I found the Novini landing of 1943-44 intriguing, to say the least. Talk to me about that.
Well, again, we've all heard of crashes at Roswell or landings at Rendlesham, and the debate of them seems to be never ending. But there's, Poland has its equivalent. And what you find when you read this information, not just from Poland, Howard, but from other countries, again, it's different. It's not, we talked about commonalities, but we also tend to forget the differences that happen. For example, when I mentioned foreigners back in 1987, the beings seen there weren't your typical little alien grey guys with the big eyes. These were 7 foot tall with small heads, and Poland has its own equivalent of that. When you see the cover of UFOs Over Poland, you will see this strange creature on the front. Well, its head looks like one big eye, and it's human, but it is based on one of the encounters in the book. So, And that it goes throughout. You know, Peter writes of sightings in early history, right the way through the 1900s, prior to the Kenneth Arnold sighting in 47, right the way through to today's modern Poland. You know, it's no longer the little sort of Soviet offshoot. It has arisen from the ashes of the former Soviet bloc, so to speak, in many instances. And it's not. You know, definitive. It is a potted history of the UFO subject in Poland.
And are there still people in Nowiny who, I hope I pronounced that properly, who have recollections of this? It is a long time ago now.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we're also talking about other things that have not. I mean, I spoke to him little the other night about some of the other things that are not in the book. One of the things that Peter has made an effort to do is to go and try and track down the original source, like we did with Without Consent. I mean, I remember travelling with Malcolm Robinson up to Scotland to speak to Robert Taylor of the Livingston incidents. You know, famous, probably Scotland's most famous encounter, and we spoke to him face to face. He's sadly no longer with us, so I'm glad we did it. And Peter's done that wherever he's had the opportunity, and continues to do so. But you see, we have modern technology now. You see, however, you know, you don't necessarily have to go and speak to them face to face. You do it on your smartphone, can't you? or Skype or whatever, you know. So there are shortcuts you can take today.
Okay, and one of just quickly, and we will, I think we ought to do a whole show about this, and maybe we'll get Peter, the author, on himself as well. So let's pencil that in for quite early in the new year if we can. But there are also, there's also talk in the book, apparently, about things that happened over and indeed under the Baltic Sea.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, you know, we're all aware of the Baltics, and like we've mentioned here, and in certainly other areas around the world, there tends to be little hot spots like the Dales, like Bonnybridge in Scotland, like Warminster in Wiltshire, and Poland has its own equivalent, if you like. And Paul calls some of them anomalous zones, but we call them window areas here. It's the same thing. And you find in these areas, Howard, that they tend to have a whole raft of paranormal phenomena, not just UFOs, but, you know, ghosts, poltergeists, myths, legends, all in this one area or one locale. And of course, somewhere like the Baltic, we've got the Baltic Sea as well. You know, you have things not just on the land, you have it on the sea and underneath.
So-called unidentified submersible objects.
Absolutely, and we touch on that as well. And again, it's another aspect of the whole subject that is little known about. So we mention it in the book, and it is absolutely fascinating. And I could, you know, I mean, Peter does speak good English, so if you want to interview him, you won't have a problem.
Okay, well, look, we need to get that going. But look, Tricia Robertson, my good friend in Scotland, who introduced us, said that you were a great talker and you and I would be able to, as we say here, talk for Britain. And we can certainly do that. So we've only scratched the surface, Philip Mantle. And thank you very much indeed for bearing up with me and my flu as we do this recording. We have to do this again. One question for you. This has been a lifelong interest for you. We've been on this earth for a similar kind of number of years. If you were to meet a so-called alien, if he was standing in your living room, what would you want to ask him or her?
That's a good question. Maybe I'd say, you know, do you like Yorkshire pudding?
Nice one, Philip Mantle. That's a great answer to my very difficult question, I think. I don't think I could answer that question, so that was excellent. Thank you. Philip Mantle, if anybody wants to read about you and your work and your publishing ventures, is there a website they can go to?
We've got a blog, but if you're interested in UFO What's Over Poland or any of my books, they'll just find them on Amazon. That's the easiest way to do it. I'm on Facebook as well, Howard, so I'm easy to find.
And you're very well represented on the search engines. I saw that this morning when I checked. So Philip Mantle, Mantle, and Philip with one L, isn't it?
It's one L, yes.
Yeah. Philip, lovely to talk with you. Thank you very much indeed. Give my love to North Yorkshire.
My pleasure.
Well, what an absolute discovery that man has turned out to be. Philip Mantle is his name, and as he said, you can find him just by searching him, really. Thank you very much indeed for bearing with me. I think the back end of my flu is beginning to abate. But I'm sorry if I haven't quite sounded like me. And I have to tell you, throughout this recording, I've been very much affected by the news that as I record this, and things may change, Art Bell is stepping down from the microphone for reasons that I completely understand. But Art, if you are happening to hear this, and I know that you do listen to me, and look, I'll tell you, I'll confide in you, my listener, that Art and I have had some conversations over the last 6 months. He's always been my inspiration, and I want to hear him back. And if I can be part of anything that he does in the future, wow, that would be fantastic. But let's hope it isn't over. You know, they say it's not over till it is. So let's hold out some hope. Until next we meet here on The Unexplained, thank you to Adam Caldwell, my webmaster at Creative Hotspot, and please stay safe, stay calm. Above all, stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.